You know, Dayton and Aviram, we are now beginning this week, this coming Shabbos, we're beginning the book of Exodus. The whole story of the Exodus, the beautiful story. One of the characters, I think in the movie Ten Commandments, Dayton is in the movie, right?
He is.
He's a famous actor.
Edward G.
Robinson.
And what was his job? I don't know about G. Robinson. What is Dayton's job there?
Troublemaker.
He oversaw Jews. He was a Jew, but he oversaw Jews for the Egyptians.
He was
basically sold out because he had a nice house and slaves, and he was Jewish.
Yeah. He was a nice couple, you say. We're going to get maybe a better view on him. But at least thank God he shows up in the movie. Then you know what I'm talking about. Thank God for the movie. Thank God for Dayton being in the movie. What's the name of the player?
Edward G. Robinson.
Edward G. Robinson. Robinson is good enough for me. Robinson.
Yeah, he played
against. Was he Jewish?
Just thinking, was he Jewish?
Robinson, it's a Jewish name.
No.
Was he Jewish?
Yeah, probably. Was he?
Was
he?
He was Jewish.
Is that his
Edward
name?
G. Robinson
is a Jew. Is a Jewish name.
Probably changed his name.
Yeah.
You can look him up.
Are you serious?
That might not have been his real name.
He always played the bad guy.
First of all, everybody else
in the movies were like... Rabbi, he was in part. He always played the bad guy.
That's true. Could have been one of the three
students. I bet you're right, Rob. I bet you that wasn't his name.
Robinson's a Jewish name. That's what I think. Okay. In the Ten Commandments movie, Dayton was a guy with the name Dayton, a troublemaker. That's what we're going to learn about him in the real thing, not in the movie. Source number one.
Who are you anyway? During those days, Moses grew up and went out to his brothers and looked at their burden. He saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man. His brother. He turned this way and that way, and he saw that there was no man. So he struck the Egyptian and hit him in the sand.
See, Moses' story starts with this thing. The first story we read about it, that Moses was born, and he was put by the water, by the river, by the Nile River, and then Pharaoh's daughter found him, right? The next story we read about him is he grew up, he came out, he knew that he was Jewish, from Jewish origin. His mother told him, his adopting mother told him that. And he went to see how his brothers are doing, how the slaves are doing. And he saw how an Egyptian officer is trying to kill a Jewish slave. And Moses looked around. He saw that nobody stands up for him. He saw that there is no Egyptian around to inform, to see what's going on. He killed him, and he buried him. Simple as that, to save the Jew. Because the officer wanted to kill the Jewish man. Okay, Rashi explains why.
Striking a Hebrew man, hitting and whipping him. This was the husband of Shlomit Bat Divri, and he had laid eyes upon her. At night he summoned him to work and made him leave his house. Then he would enter and come upon his wife. She thought it was her husband. When the husband returned and found out, this Egyptian beat him all day.
See what happened? Was a story. She was a beautiful woman, and he put the eyes on her. He pulled him out of the house early in the morning to go to work, and then he walked in and he did what he did. And by the time, what he realized, the husband discovered what happened. And the Egyptian officer was afraid that the husband would report him to the guys above him. You cannot do such things. Even in Egypt, it's not officially. You cannot behave like this. Then he wanted to kill him. And then Moses showed up in the right moment, in the right time, the right second. And he saw the guy wants to kill him. He shouldn't give out the secret. And Moses came, and he saw, he looked around. So there is nobody there to stand up for him. There is nobody there to report. Then he killed him. Now, for killing an Egyptian officer in Egypt, think about 1940, killing an SS guard in Berlin. It's not going to go through like this. You deserve that for it. No matter who you are, even if you are the son, the adopted son of the prince. And Moses knew he's taking a huge risk. But that's what made Moses Moses. This is one of Moses' resume. If you want to know what's Moses' resume, why God chose them, this is the first story. Soon we'll come to the second story. That's what is Moses' resume are the three stories. He killed and he stood up for a Jew. Then when he saw two Jewish people were fighting, he tried to stop them. Then when he came to Midian and he saw how they're attacking Jethro's daughters, he stood up for them. These are the stories that make, that tell you who Moses is. Okay, go ahead.
At this point, is Moses still kind of part of the palace? Or
sure, very much. Yeah, for a little bit, not for much longer. Okay, continue.
Moses went out on the second day, and behold, two Hebrew men were quarreling. Moses said to the wicked one, "Why are you going to strike your fellow?"
Two guys are fighting.
Two
and one second, two guys are fighting. And one second, and they, one want, then Moses turns to one of them and says, "Why are you going to hurt your brother? Your brothers, your Jews, why are you fighting?" Who are the two? Go ahead.
Rashi. Two Hebrew men, Dathan and Abiram.
This is the beginning of Dathan and Abiram's career. In English, Dathan, in Hebrew, Datan. Okay.
He retorted, "Who made you a man, a prince, and a judge over us? Do you plan to slay me like you slayed the Egyptian?" Moses became frightened and said, "Indeed, the matter has become known."
Okay, then what happened is like this. Moses, is the guy, the Jewish guy, told him, "Who are you to tell us what to do? Don't you think we don't know what happened yesterday? You think you can do whatever you want here? Who are you?" And according to Midrashim, Dathan, the guy who is saved from being killed, was Dathan. Then Aviram was his friend. Now Dathan was fighting at Aviram. Dathan or Aviram told Moses, "What do you think you are? You're the boss here?" That the guy that he saved, that was the guy who turned them in. They reported them to the government. I don't know why it's not written in English here. This another piece is missing here in English. Pharaoh heard the news. He gave out a death sentence to Moses. "What do you mean you're killing Egyptian officers?" And Moses had to run away to Midian. That was then.
But he's a prince.
He's a prince. A prince,
he's
a prince.
A lot more things.
A prince until I decide you're not a prince. What means a prince? Pharaoh knew that he's adopted. Pharaoh knew that he comes from a Jewish origin. That his daughter just cried and kvetched, that he let her raise him. But during the time the guy's doing whatever he wants, get out of here.
So Pharaoh was sort of closing his eyes on Moses up to this point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Moses wasn't doing anything special at that
time. No, Moses was a very...
Like she brought the dog from a shelter.
What?
Like she brought a dog from a shelter and he let her keep
it. He let her keep it. No, your daughter starts crying, kvetching. You say, okay, just keep him. Just leave me alone. But by the time he starts to disobey the law, he probably gave it over to his... To the court, and the court says he deserves death. Moses became a wanted one that you put, the pictures in the post office. Moses was a wanted one. He had to run away from Egypt, and he was in Midian, two opinions, 60 years or 4 years. Until, after this story, you don't see him in Egypt until God sent him to really redeem the Jewish people.
Is the moral character of Dathan?
You can just imagine what a nice guy he was.
Yeah. did Moses rethink his original decision to save?
Maybe I should
not. Person.
Did he rethink the original decision? I don't think so, because the third story that's not written here proves that he didn't, because he went to Midian. He ran away to Midian. He comes to Midian, a stranger in a strange land, a guy who is wanted in Egypt. He's only going to Midian. He goes to the well. He sees there is a few girls came there to draw water, and he sees how the locals are harassing them in many ways. Moses stood up to save them, to protect them. He gave them the water. They went home. They told the father asked him, "Why was you so early? Came back already?" He said, "Oh, it was like an Egyptian man who helped us and saved us." Why didn't Jethro had 8 daughters, I think, something like this. I told him, "Why you didn't bring him home?" Guys,
can get rid of one, maybe.
They brought him home. He actually married his oldest daughter.
So I did interracial marriage at the time.
I mean, Jethro says, "You're already finding somebody loves you, go and lives with you." Why didn't bring him on? That from the story that he stood up for Jethro's daughters, for a strange people he never met. Not his brothers, not Hebrews, nothing, not Jewish. In a strange land, what are you getting involved in a fight that you don't know anything about? Tells you that he didn't regret. That's what Moses. Moses was a man who will stand up always for the underdog. Especially when it was Jewish brothers. But, as Rashi says, when he saw this story, he got really upset. He says, now I know why they're having so much tzores. If they can inform on their own brother who saved their life. What's going to be? That's the second story with Dathan and Aviram. Just, you should know who Dathan and Aviram are, the two nice guys. I mean, the first story was... that's the first story, basically. The whole first story. Okay, go ahead.
Just because.
Now there is another story. For them later, when the Jews already left Egypt, they are in the desert. And God, you know, they complain, they want to have... There is in the desert, there is no food. They run out of matzah. It was 30 days after they were in the desert. God says, we'll give you manna. Oh, Baruch Hashem, manna. Moses tells them, the manna will be every day of the week, and you have to finish it by the day. Whatever is for the day, don't leave over for tomorrow. You know, everybody loves to leave a little bit in the refrigerator. Should have for tomorrow. But what if his wife doesn't cook? What are you going to do? Yes, so you come to tomorrow. Leftovers? Judaism doesn't believe in leftovers. You should just know.
Oh,
my poor friend.
We can leave now.
Cancels out my whole life. What are we talking about?
Judaism, that's my belief. Judaism doesn't believe in leftovers. There is I have a few proofs for it, but that's a different story. Okay. What? Here we don't have never have leftovers in this place. But when you have leftovers.
You know, when the summer's over, you have the...
Shalashuras?
Yeah.
Shalashuras, you eat nothing. You don't have leftovers. Okay, go ahead.
Source 2. God spoke to Moses saying, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Say to them, in the afternoon you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be sated with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. Then in the evening the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. The layer of dew rose up, and behold, on the surface of the desert, a fine bare substance as fine as frost was on the ground. When the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna, because they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it is the bread that God has given you to eat. This is the thing that God has commanded. Gather from it, every person, as much as they can eat, an omer for each person. According to the number of persons, each one for those in his tent you shall take. The children of Israel did so. They gathered, both the one who gathered much and the one who gathered little. They measured it with an omer, and whoever gathered much did not have more, and whoever gathered little did not have less.
That's first of all, that's life. You think you gather a lot, you have more. You don't get 1 inch more than you deserve. And if you gather too much, you waste it on bad things and doctors and on breaking refrigerators and on those and onions. You will get exactly what you deserve. You gather a little, if you're some a nice guy, you gather only a little bit and you think, oh, I'm such a loser, I don't gather, or your wife thinks you're such a loser, you don't even, you'll get what you deserve. You know, people think the work on Shabbos, they make more money. The money from Shabbat goes to bad places. Goes to doctors, go to broken cars and broken refrigerators and schleps good money with it. Whatever you belongs to you, it will come to you in a kosher way. You don't have to work extra. It will not help you anything. You just slave yourself and then just nothing good comes out of it. That was a side note. Continue.
They measured it with an omer, and whoever gathered much did not have more, and whoever gathered little did not have less. Each one according to his eating capacity gathered. Moses said to them, let no one leave over any of it until morning. But some men did not obey Moses and left over some of it until morning, and it bred worms and became putrid, and Moses became angry with them.
Some men, Dathan and Aviram.
The stories of the show.
Wherever you go, the rabbis decided that every Dreykov, that every problem that Moses has, it was always Dathan and Aviram. These two made all the tzores. Then here is again, by the way, I have another proof for you for leftovers. It's not good in Judaism. You know, the Passover lamb in the temple. You have to lay that either the whole night, this night, you know, no leftovers. I'm telling you, guys, tell your wives, there's no leftovers. Cook yourself. Okay, then Dathan and Aviram were the people who made, not only does the continuation of the stories, then Moses told them on Shabbos will not go manna. There were some people who came out to look for manna on Shabbat. Who are the some people? Dathan and Aviram. They always tried to discredit Moses. That's what they tried.
The more antagonists.
Sure, it was all about, they were all, you see in history, every great man had opponents. Because in Judaism, if this great Moses is, if nobody is against him, then there is no free choice. You understand?
Right.
You have to people. Moses comes down. God told me, hey, B, C, and D. If there is no opponent, then everybody there is no. You have to have a Dathan and Aviram on one side. You have to have a Moses on the other side, and you have to make choices. And throughout this Jewish history, there were always opponents to the greatest leaders of the Jewish people. The Rebbe had staunch opponents. We call them Dathan and Aviram.
They weren't part of Korah, were they? Related to Korah?
Oh, wait. They're related to them. They're from the tribe of Reuben. They're not. But sure, they're related to Korah. Sure. state troublemakers everywhere. That's where actually the name is written clearly. That's the first time, I think the only time that their name is written in the text. Okay. Go ahead, Brotherman.
Okay. Let's appoint the new leader and go to Egypt, search for Egypt.
You know, the story is when Moses sent, throughout the history of the desert, Moses sent 12 spies to spy the land of Israel, to come back and give a report. Moses wanted to come back and to say, the land is good, we were in Rosh Hanikra, we were in the Dead Sea, it's so beautiful. They came and said that the land is a nice land, but the people there are very strong, we'll never make it, it's not going to work. Basically, it's not going to work. You know, it's never a good time to conquer the, you know, when 1948, when Ben-Gurion wanted to establish the State of Israel, America and France and all them, now it's not a good time. That he said, it's never going to be a good time. And that's the truth. Comes to Israel, it's never a good time.
The same
Dathan and Aviram are existing today. Okay, then what happened? The 12 spies came back. 10 of them said it's not working. What was the reaction of the people? Go ahead.
The entire community raised their voices and shouted, and the people wept on that night.
The whole nation cried, "Oy vey, what's going to be with us?" Okay, all the children.
All the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the entire congregation said, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this desert. Why does God bring us to this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be as spoils. Is it not better for us to return to Egypt?"
You hear? They're already here out of Egypt. They said, "No, we're going to go to Israel to die in the sword, to be killed, or to die in the desert of Thursday. Let's go back to Egypt." In 1 minute, in one message, they came back from the guys came back from Israel, and the Jews changed their mind in 1 second. They forgot that they suffered in Egypt. They forgot the 8 years of slavery. They forgot of the 10 plagues. They forgot of the splitting of the sea. Everything. They're going back to Egypt.
Was this before or after they got the Torah?
This is after they got the Torah. Sure, after they got the Torah.
It's not new.
After the Golden Calf, after the Torah, after everything.
But it's not new. It's the same behavior.
Okay. Finish the Rashi. Rabbeinu Bechaya.
They said to each other, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt."
Who they said to each other? They said to each other, "Let's appoint." Yeah? They forget about Moses. It's crazy. He has dreams. He's going to Israel. "Let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt." Who? Go ahead. Dathan told Aviram, "Let's appoint a leader and go back to Egypt." Wow. Dathan and Aviram.
Rabbi, yes. There are still people that remember slavery in Egypt.
Still people? The whole nation. This is 1 year after they left Egypt.
Oh, I see. This is not
1 year after they left Egypt.
So this is
one year.
Okay.
It's actually exactly a year and a half after the period.
So no one had died.
Nobody died. Nobody died. No, nobody died.
So
maybe a few.
The original people that left Egypt.
This is the same.
That's why they turned so quickly.
This is the same Jews and the same.
So what does it say? Like they are weak-minded and they can't look forward. They can't follow the leader, or they just.
They forget very quickly. Yeah. Human beings forget very quickly.
It's just the normal people.
That's yeah.
It's scary to start a new thing.
That's us. We laugh at them. That's us.
And they forgot the whole Egyptian army was.
You know, the problem is, I heard once from a rabbi, he says, we read the Bible, and we say, they are so bad, they are. And he says, look at me, oh, it's you. It's not them, it's us. In a minute, we're already going, maybe it's not such a good idea. You know?
Not all of them.
One second. For sure, not all of them.
I mean, there's always a group who's like,
no,
we're
you
going
understand.
Forward.
No, but the problem is, nobody stood up to them. It means they are all of them. That the silent majority is worth nothing.
Gaza is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Supposedly people are for, but a certain political party took power, and then everybody was like,
"Yeah."
And now 60% would, if there would be elections for Hamas today, would be 60% electing
more.
Even more. You're right, more.
Yeah.
The point is, sure, they're not. Not everybody is ready to go and kill. I mean, Gaza is even worse than that, but. Even in Germany, there's a sign. The society, they want it. They're for it. That's the point. You know, when people in the same thing we story, Golden Calf, at every story, why Moses was so upset? Where was the rest of the people who didn't think it's a good idea? Why didn't stand up? Any case, now we come to the climax. Source number four.
Equality. Source four, number 15.
This is the story of Korach. Remember the story of Korach? Korach was fighting Moses. He was questioning Moses' authority if he speaks in the name of God. Until now, they were fighting with Moses an agenda. They don't want to go to Israel. They don't want to listen to him, what he says, man. But nobody ever questioned Moses if his Moses is Moses, if he's authentic. Maybe he doesn't say. Here they're actually asking him, who says he speaks in the name of God? Well, he makes up stories. Pashas Korach.
Yeah.
Oh, in vain. Should have another bar mitzvah.
Korach, the son of Yizchar, the son of Levi, took himself to one side along with Datan and Abiram.
Oh, finally in the text we see the names. Until now, the commentary says it was Datan and Abiram. This is the first time that the text says it. Maybe one more time, but yeah, this is.
So these are the children of Reuben.
Yeah, continue.
The sons of Eliab and An, the son of Pelet, the sons of Reuben.
Yeah.
They confronted Moses together with 250 men from the children of Israel, chieftains of the congregation, representatives of the assembly, and men of repute. They assembled against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves. The entire congregation are all holy. And Hashem is in their midst. Why do you raise yourselves above Hashem's assembly?"
They say, "Why? Why do you think you're greater than us? Who are you, Moses and Aaron? We were all at Mount Sinai. We all heard the words. You know, until Mount Sinai, it was Moses who speaks to God. We don't speak to God, and we need to listen to him. We were all at Mount Sinai. We heard God too. What are you going around like a big chochem? That's that he speaks every day to God. That's a different story. Who cares? But it's good enough for an argument." For to scream on the news, you don't need deeper this. From the river to the sea, you don't need much. Nobody has to think. It's good enough for an argument. We were all there. Who are you, Bechal? Well, you're not the leaders. Dayton, you know what happened to them in the end? In this story, they were swallowed in the earth. That was the end of their career. That was the last time we heard from them. They were so bad. I mean, in the story of Korach, when there is a chapter, I think 106 in the book of Psalms, who describes the whole exodus from Egypt. And when it comes to the story of Korach, he doesn't even mention Korach. He mentions Datan and Aviram. Why? Because Korach had good intentions. It was in one time, one failure. He messed up. But Datan and Aviram were the real troublemakers. They were consistent making tzoros.
And Korach's sons repented.
Korach's sons, they were gone.
But hold on, Korach, didn't he,
they were
followed with the families, whoever was there?
Yeah, they were sons. His sons didn't. His sons survived.
Oh, they
like, when the
earth opened, they didn't fall all the way through. They only fell on a ledge.
Somehow they survived.
Yeah, something like that.
They survived. That's, we have in the book of Psalms prayers from the sons of Korah. It's called Livnei Korah, from descendants of Korah, basically. Okay, now we're going back to the first story. Now that we know, this was the background of Korah. Now you know, Dathan and Aviram. Well, the two...
Does it say what happens to them?
Yeah, we know that. It's in the text. They were swallowed up. We don't have to go in this business. That's not the issue. We try to avoid negativity as much as possible. Okay.
So,
your guide, I'm sorry,
so,
please.
Dathan and Abiram are the two that were fighting in Egypt.
In Egypt, yes.
Moses. And now they're back again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were every time fighting with Moses. But they always challenged Moses' authority.
And they are the descendants of Reuben?
Yes.
And is On, is that a name?
On. I mean, like On in America, in English, there's On, and all this. Now, On
okay,
would be,
so, oh,
would go to perfectly as a name in America. On.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Scholars ever, hypothesize what Moses would have done had the earth not swallowed them up? I mean, he would have had a moment there to confront them, I guess.
No, I'll tell you what happened is, Moses says, if I speak in the name of God, the earth will open your mouth. If I don't speak in the name of God, nothing will happen to them.
I mean, prior to that, God already...
He comforted them.
So many things he
not only, like no, I mean, Moses tried to convince them to get over this, to try to make peace with them. Moses went to them. He called them to come to his office. They didn't want to come. Moses went to their tent, tried to convince them. He said, save yourself. It's not going to end well.
He tried to reason.
And he begged them. But, Moses felt bad for them. Moses is... He loved every Jew, even them. Even these Ludnikes who gave him hell all throughout the system. But they didn't want. They were so stubborn. We get into a fight, you don't see anything. You're so blind, you don't see what is happening.
But still, Rabbi, think about it. Like, they knew all the miracle, all these things was happened, kind of. And they still was questioning this.
Oh, must be that there was something more to them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's where we're going. Eventually we'll get to it.
There he goes.
No, you're right. There is something to it.
I mean, if you want to do your profile, then like this, social muzzle to...
Listen, how many proofs people, there is argument about giving the land of Israel to the Palestinians or not. How many times we tried. And people still say, let's give it a chance. The same thing. They tried to save Joseph. He tried to save Joseph. He tried. He didn't. He tried. But he tried. Give him credit for this.
And it's his descendants.
It's his descendants. It's years later. It's not. It's
about 120 years.
More. It's 200. They were 210 years later. They came out from Egypt after they came into Egypt. That's about 230 years after the story with Joseph or something like this. Yeah, 230 years. Okay, source number 5.
B, rising a hand is wicked. Raising a hand. Source 5, Maimonides, Mishnah, Torah, Chovel.
Go ahead, don't worry about it.
One who strikes an innocent Jew, whether child or adult, man or woman, violates a negative commandment.
Number 1. If you strike another Jew, you're violating a commandment from the Torah. You're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to hurt another Jew. Okay.
Even raising a hand to strike is forbidden.
Even, now it goes another step. Even raising a hand on somebody else, just to say, like this, is not allowed. Continue.
And one who raises a hand even without striking is wicked.
One who raises a hand on another Jew and he didn't need him is considered a rasha, a wicked man.
Just what about self-defense?
You're not talking innocent. About self-defense. You're talking about an innocent person.
Exactly.
Striking an innocent Jew. You're attacking another person. Self-defense is a whole different story.
The intention to intimidate, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's even what it is. To want. Exactly. Right. Even to want to.
Children fight all the time, right? There's nothing wicked about it.
Children is children. Children are not younger than bar mitzvah. You're not responsible for mitzvahs. But yeah, but you educate them not to do it. If you're not educating them when they're young, they will continue to do it after bar mitzvah too. But okay, read the source number six.
Source number six. Reish Lakish said, "One who raises hand against the fellow, even without striking them, is deemed wicked. As the verse says, he said to the wicked one, 'They are going to strike your fellow.' He does not state why did you strike, but that you are going to strike. Even without striking, he was deemed wicked."
Says like this, as long as all we know, we're the Maimonides, we're the Talmud takes the idea that if you lift up your hand, you're already considered wicked. Because Moses turned to two people who were fighting, and he told them, "Why are you going to strike your friend?" He didn't tell them why you're striking. They didn't even start to fight. He tells them, "Lomo sake, why are you going to strike your friend?" Obviously, if you're going to strike your friend, you're already considered a Roshe. It's written like this. He turned to the wicked one and he told him, "Why are you going to strike your friend?" It said to the Roshe. It's not to, why are you striking? Oh, your fellow, not your friend. Oh, what's the difference between fellow and friend? It's the same thing.
How's it written in Hebrew? Different. What's the word?
Vayomer la Roshe. Vayomer la Rasha. He told to the wicked one, "Lama takerecha? Why you eat your friend?" What is reacho? What's the difference between fellow and friend?
Fellow's not necessarily a friend. It's a fellow person,
an acquaintance,
not a friend.
Reacho is a friend.
Friend is a closer relationship
than a
fellow.
Yeah, I understand that.
I mean, v'afto l'reacho kamoicho is love your fellow like yourself. Is your fellow not a friend?
Yeah.
Okay, a fellow. Even a fellow is not allowed to eat. Right, if he's Jewish, you're not allowed to even lift up your hand. And if you lift up your hand, then the whole thing out, the rabbis learned it, it's from the story with Dathan and Aviram. Moses came out the second day, saw two people are arguing. He turned to one, he turned to the wicked, that's the language in the Bible. And he told them, "Why you want to strike your fellow?"
No exceptions?
No exceptions.
Innocent.
Yes. Talking about intent, right?
It's the wicked end of the table over there.
It's like in the legal firm, it's malice, right? Intent.
Yeah. What means? Malice, that means what?
In intent. Right?
Intent, yeah, intent. You're not, is intent counted too, right?
Or with hatred in your heart.
Threat or intimidation or harassment.
Yeah.
But if there's no malice, then you're not legal.
Okay, source number seven. Shh, guys, let's move on.
"We have been cautioned against a hint of striking, even without an actual blow. The Talmud says, 'One who raises a hand against a fellow is deemed wicked.' As the verse says, 'He said to the wicked one, why are you going to strike?'"
Yeah, that's basically the same thing from another source. We'll continue the Rebbe's. Now we'll come to the Rebbe's talk.
"Since when are intentions punishable? It is a basic principle of Torah law that people aren't punished for negative thoughts and intentions. People can only be punished if their intentions were actualized."
I wanted to do. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I picked up my hand because my nose was robbing me. Where is I don't know what I wanted to do. Go ahead, continue.
"This raises the question, why is the person that merely raised their hand against their fellow without actually striking them termed wicked? This person didn't actually harm anyone, neither physically nor financially. He did raise his hand, but the strike remained in the realm of intentions and wasn't actualized. Moreover, no person can truly know what is in his fellow's heart. Therefore, so long as there is no actual strike, you can't be fully certain about the person's true intention."
It's a known rule in Jewish law. You don't know what in the other person's heart. You cannot judge him for it. You can only judge him for action. Then if in action he didn't do anything, what do you want from him? Did I did it? No, have a nice day. Where is the punishment here?
But what if their intentions were bad, but the outcome ended up being good for whatever. Like, I mean, I'm not talking about the striking, but or like just in general. Like,
that still is to be. Even if the outcome was, let's say, the brothers of Joseph sold them, right, as a slave. Mm-hmm. Then the outcome was very good. He became the ruler of Egypt, and he saved the family. Joseph told them, you had bad intention, but God did that for the good. Are the 10 brothers did a good thing, or they deserve a punishment? They deserve a punishment. They sold the brother, right? Then even if the outcome was good, it's still, from a God's point of view, it's very nice, but they sold the brother.
So a behavior is bad if its intention is bad.
No. If it, whatever you did, action counts. We don't punish you for intentions. We punish you for your actions. That's the question. Why here? There was no actions. Why is it? Where's the punishment? Read the. You want to continue number two?
The law is that the person who raises their hand against their fellow is disqualified from serving as a witness.
Aha! There is a punishment here. If I picked up my hand to hurt somebody else, in Beidin, they say, you cannot be a witness. We cannot believe you. These kind of people who are beating up other people, we cannot trust them on anything. You're disqualified as a witness. It's a big punishment. Can you imagine? Somebody tells you, can you testify for me? So no, the Beidin doesn't accept my testimony. It's huge. Continue. You make him disqualified for testimony, and what? And he picked up, I'm picking up his hand, an intention. We know we have a rule in the Torah: you don't judge people by their intention. That's the question. Number three, only by hand.
Only by hand. The warning: one who raises their hand against their fellow implies that picking with a foot would be different.
Yeah. Oh, if he lift up his hand, that is a wicked man. If he wanted to give him a good kick, and he already picked up his hand to give him his foot, that's not. What's the difference? Who cares? If it was in the foot, or in the hand, or with his nose, who cares with what? Continue.
The words that serve as the source of this law use the word strike without specifying hand or foot. The law should.
You see, when we learn from the Bible, we learn the story that Moses saw two people are fighting. He told the wicked. It's not written there he picked up his hand or gave him the foot. It's written he saw two people fighting. He told to the wicked one, why you want to fight your brother? Then where the Talmud got his business with the end? And maybe with the foot. It's not written in the text. Go ahead.
The rules have been worded accordingly. Anyone who intended to strike their fellow, even if they didn't actually strike, is a wicked person. Why then does the law specify raising one hand?
Exactly. Why raising one hand? Okay. Go ahead.
There are two parts, Rebbe. Hand, Kometzvot. There is a key difference between the hands and the feet and the other parts of the body. Most of our productive actions and work are done with our hands. This is also true at other extreme. Most damage is because it's also done with our hands. The feet, by contrast, primarily serve the function of the walking from one place to another, not fixing buildings.
You know the expression in English, I wash my hand from it? Why is it written, I wash my nose from it, my face from it? Your hand are the source for all the good things, and your hand are the source of all the bad things. Most of the accomplishment that you have in your life, you do with your hand, with your 10 fingers. If your one finger is hurting you, you realize how much you need it. Your legs are just taking you from point A to point B, in general. Main part of your life of accomplishment is at your end. Continue.
This difference is the result of the different location on the human body. The hands are in the middle of the body, closer to the head, and they have 5 fingers capable of executing fine skills. The feet are located at the bottom of the body. Their toes are suited only for walking.
The hands are made, they're right in the right place. God created the human being, he put them in the right place. With your hand, you can reach everything you can do. You can go up, you can go down. With your hand, with your feet, you cannot do it. Only if you do yoga.
Soccer. Part of why we do the ritual hand washing?
That's part. Why you wash the hand? Yeah. Why you don't wash?
Purify
your hand. Why you purify your hand? Because you, with your hand you can do all the good things and all the bad things. Yes. Yes, exactly this. Yes.
This can be seen or reflected in the teaching of sages. That prior to Noah, all people who are born without separated fingers, because they didn't need to work the earth. Noah was the first to be born with separated fingers.
You know that? You never heard that.
Ah. Never heard that.
Just, we just put it in just to teach you there is much more to learn. Until Noah, people had closed them like this. There was no separated finger. They couldn't do anything with their hand. Because nobody had to walk the world like in Dubai. Everybody's like a king. I mean, slaves are doing things.
How did they do things? How did they get
it? It was
food?
It was a very good world. They didn't have to plow. It was a very good a good place.
So Adam and Eve had hands like that?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe
did
Adam and Eve.
Did you reflect on the painting that we see now? Mm-hmm.
There's a painting of that?
No, obviously not.
We're talking about one in
the huh?
in chapels.
Then we see from the story of the Medrash about Noah how important hands are. This difference, continue.
This difference is also reflected in the realm. This is the purpose of human creation.
Mm-hmm.
The entire human body was created in order to serve God. However, this is most strongly expressed in a person's hand, more so than in their feet and their wings.
You see, a person is created to serve God. Why we are here? To celebrate New Year's. It's nice. But why we are here? We are here to serve God, to do good in the world. But where is this most reflected? In which part of your body you can say, this is the most dedicated thing to do mitzvahs, to do good? At your hand. With your back, you cannot do much good. I mean, with your face, you can do a lot of good. You can smile to somebody, make him a good day. You can twist the nose on him, you make him a bad day. You give him a bad look, a good look. But the real work is at your hand. You can do all amazing good things at your hand. Mao too.
What about mind? What about brain?
Brain, if you have one, that's. Well, you know, half of the world does not have one.
You have one.
You're being very generous.
Go ahead.
Our hands were created in order to perform its work. As the Alter Rebbe writes, the hands distributes charity or does another mitzvah.
With your hand, you don't give charity. You need your hand. Why you need your hand to give charity?
As we see, most people.
You know, when the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was in jail in Russia, and he couldn't spread Judaism, he said, "I wished that my hand should be dried out." He felt that his hand doesn't do what it's supposed to do. He says, "I could write letters to make people, inspire people to do mitzvahs. If I cannot do what I'm supposed to do, well, I don't have to be here." That's how strongly he felt about it. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
As we see, most mitzvot are achieved through the hands. The same is true of other extremes. Most transgressions and destructive acts are also performed.
You're still with your hand. You have all the good things, everything is then. That's why you wash the hand. What do you think? Yeah? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The feet, by contrast, are primarily for walking and not usually directly involved in mitzvot observance. Put differently, the feet generally serve as enabler for mitzvot or transgressions. As the Mishnah says, run towards.
You run to a mitzvah and you run away from a sin, from a transgression. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Run towards even a light mitzvah and feed from transgressions. And flee from
flee, yeah.
But the hands are directly involved in giving charity and performing many others as well.
You put on film with your hand, you light candles with your hand, you say a motzi with your hand, everything is your hand. Then that's why when you do, that's what is, okay, go ahead, continue.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yeah.
The Rebbe, the what we see now, because,
no.
But everything he did that I see, so he's talking to people, he's on the phone, he's on microphones, he's on videos, he's on everything, and everything he's giving to us is coming from his mouth, from his
obviously
brain,
because
it's all
teaching. But the Rebbe himself gave out dollars for thousands of hours, I can say.
Yes.
We would think he could have to give, you know, in the early days, he used to give it to designated people, and they gave out the dollars to everybody else. The Rebbe chose, in the last 6-7 years of his life, on the age of 85 until 90, the Rebbe himself stood on his feet for 7 hours and gave everyone $1. Why do you think he did that? Because he wanted to, with his own hand, to do the mitzvah. He wanted to become a vehicle to the mitzvah, purposely. Because it's all about dedicating your own body. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Don't raise.
Don't raise. Based on the above, we can understand the severity of raising a hand against one's fellow. The prohibition to raise a hand against a fellow is not just because it can lead to a strike. The very raising of the hand itself is the problem. When a person takes their hand, which was created to do mitzvah, to help others in the light, and raise it against their fellow, they are abusing the purpose and nature of the hand.
You understand what is happening here? It's worse than doing any other part. This hand that I gave you to do so many mitzvahs, with this hand you went and you hurt people. That's why God is so upset about that. It's like if you give somebody, there is a person who is hungry in the street, tell them, here is $20 to buy food. And with this $20, he went and he bought drugs. That's much more upsetting than if he did it on his own or whatever. When you give, you do something designated for doing good, and the person is using the same thing to do bad, is much more upsetting than if it's a bite waiting. Then because the end is created to do so much good, and with the end you go and you hurt somebody, it's much more insulting and hurting. I think it's much more insulting if somebody gives you a slap in your face with his hand, or he's giving you a kick with his feet. Because it's
personal.
It's much more, for some reason, people will take it, will be much stronger. Because that's what the Rebbe says. And the problem is not with them that you wanted to hurt your friend, that you want to hurt them, you picked up your hand with your hand, you wanted to do it, not just you wanted to do it.
Like giving money to Palestine, and it's not being used appropriately.
Yeah, yeah. There is. I can give another 50,000 examples for this. Right.
Such a person right. Branded wicked and is disqualified.
He's branded wicked. Branded. That's the word.
Yeah.
Right.
Not because they intended to hit their fellow, but because by raising their hand against another person, they use their hand for the opposite of the purpose for which it was created.
Exactly.
This is the meaning of the term wicked. A wicked person is someone who acts against the purpose for which they were created. Humans were created in order to serve their creator, and the person is doing the opposite. This is why the sages say that no person transgresses unless they have been possessed by a spirit of foolishness. Transgression is contrary to logic and contrary to human nature.
Yes. Then the point is, like, it's all person. God tells you, I gave you a life, and you go and you ruin it. You're doing the opposite. But we read this coming out the most expressed way in your end. That's why the end are more important than the rest of the body. That's why we wash our end. That's why it's all about the end. Because the end, with the end, you can do the most important things. The best thing in the world, you can do the worst thing. And the mouth is the same thing, yeah. The tongue is the same thing. Go ahead, psychiatrist.
All right. The Rebbe, self-sacrifice for the Jewish people. We can now also understand the fact that the support for the law that a person who raises their hand against their fellow is called wicked comes from a verse written about Dathan and Abiram. And he said to the wicked person, why are you going to strike your fellow? Dathan and Abiram were the officers who suffered beatings for their work to lighten the burden of the Jewish people. They risked their lives by going to Pharaoh to demand that he improve the conditions of the Jewish slaves. They were so devoted that they even had the audacity to speak disrespectfully to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, may God look upon you and judge.
Oh, Nathan and Abiram were not just two idiots or making tzores. There was a good side to them. That's what Michael Dushinsky first asked. Nathan and Abiram, you need to understand, whoever makes it to the Bible, even the bad guys, aren't special. It would be just nudnikes. They wouldn't even make it to the Bible. I did not make it to the Bible. If they made it to the Bible, there is something very unique about them. Dathan and Abiram, there is a story in the Bible, right in the end of, when Moses, God sent, you know, Moses didn't want to be the leader, right? And God told him, I want you to be the leader for the Jewish people. Moses says, no, I don't want to. He found every excuse in the book. Send them. I have a speech impediment. I have this. Every excuse, I'm too tired, I'm busy, I'm this. 7 days he was arguing with God. 7 days. You know, with God, you don't argue in a minute. 7 days, that's a long time. And finally, God told him, go. He went. I told them, take the elders of Israel, they'll go with you, and you will speak to, you become a whole delegation, speak to Pharaoh. By the time they made it to Pharaoh's palace, all the delegation, the whole delegation was busy. They all disappeared. Because going to Pharaoh, in front of Pharaoh's palace were piles of legs and limbs. Everybody who... anybody who thought it's a chochem will end up in pieces. Then, you know, when you see these piles, you say, you know what? I have an important appointment. I have a doctor's appointment now. My wife called me. I'm very busy. Then the bottom line was left with Moses and Aaron. Moses looked at Aaron, Aaron looked at Moses. They said, God told us to go. We have no choice. They walked into Pharaoh's palace. He told them, let my people go. Pharaoh said, what? Let my people go. I never heard of such a God. I don't know this story. Because of that, he got so upset. He made it worse for the Jewish people, for the slaves. Until now, the government used to provide them with the straw, and the Jews made from the straw bricks. Now, it says, no more providing you with straw. You will collect your own straw, and you'll have to make the same amount of bricks. Then the work became 10 times worse. The situation of the Jewish people became much worse. Then a delegation of the Jewish, now it was Jewish couples. The slavery system was, let's say every 20 Jews have one Jew that's in charge of them. And this Jew has to deliver to the police, to the Egyptian police, in the amount of, let's say, 100 bricks a day from these 20 people. If he didn't deliver enough bricks, he was beaten up. The Jewish policeman was beaten up. In Egypt, not like by the Holocaust, in Egypt, the Jewish policemen got the beating for the Jews. They had Rachmanes Center brothers. They worked so hard. They used to show up at night with less bricks. They killed them. They beat them up. Then this Jewish policeman went to Pharaoh, and they told him, what are you doing to the Jews? Why are you doing it? Pharaoh says, you have dreams about leaving Egypt? I'll show you what means leaving Egypt. You're lazy. You have time to dream. You work so hard, you don't have time for dreams. Just like in, you know, like in the Soviet Union. You double down. You don't have to make it even worse. You know, okay, now that you know the story, we'll get to the... Go ahead. You read it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
The officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster had appointed over them, were beaten, saying, why have you not completed your quota to make bricks like the day before yesterday, neither yesterday nor today? So the officers of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why do you do this to your servants? Stubble is not given to your servants, but they tell us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are beaten and your people are sinning.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But he said, you are lazy, just lazy. This is why you say, let us go. Let us sacrifice to God. Now, go and work, but you will not be given stubble. Nevertheless, you must produce the same number of bricks.
In the Shiva, they used to use this expression, lazy, you're lazy, get to work. Don't give us excuses. Go ahead.
The officers of the children of Israel saw them in distress, saying, do not reduce the number of your bricks, the requirement of each day in its day. They met Moses and Aaron standing before them when they came out from Pharaoh's presence. They said to them, may God look upon you and judge, for you have made us obnoxious in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to place a sword into their hands to kill us.
What happened is, they went to Pharaoh to complain. Pharaoh says, no, you're lazy, I'm not changing my mind. Go out and walk. They walk out from Pharaoh's office, Moses and Aaron coming back again to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. The Jewish delegation goes out and said that God will judge you. It's because of you things got so bad. Always the Jews blame their own brothers for the tzores. They said it's your fault. You know, it was in the uprising in Warsaw Ghetto was a fight. Many Jews were against the uprising, and they gave over the leader of the uprising. He had to go out and give himself over to the Nazis because the Jews were pushing him to give up because they blamed them for all the tzores. In any case, here, they also told him, it's your fault. They told Moses, because of you, if you wouldn't come to Pharaoh, the whole thing wouldn't happen. Well, the two told Moses, it's because of you.
This was Datan
and Aviram. Uh-huh. Then Datan and Aviram was not just troublemakers. They felt, they began beating for Moses. They were beaten up for Moses, for the Jewish people. They felt that they are protecting the Jewish people. Not everybody who wants a Palestinian state is an enemy of the Jewish people. In his mind, he's saving the Jewish people. He might be wrong, but that's what he's thinking. They said, well, Moses, look at the stories you had. We had We were slaves, but the government gave us bricks. Life was, we could survive it. Now you guys come with ideas, let's save the Jewish people. Look what you did, you made things worse. And actually, Moses turned to God later and says, God, didn't I tell you I don't want to go to Pharaoh? Didn't I tell you I don't want, look what happened because of me. I became a cause for Tzoras. God told him, don't worry, it's going to be better. But you see from this story, the Rebbe's job is to show that in every person there is some good. In every story in the Bible, not just evil, 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 evil. They were always feeling that they are trying to save the Jewish people. They're doing it for the right reason. That's what they felt. The Rebbe, go ahead.
The Rebbe. Dayton and Aviram were lovers of the Jewish people by nature.
Lovers of the Jewish people. It's not the same Dayton we learned until now.
Their fight between themselves was drastically contrary to their nature. And this is why he said to the wicked one, why are you going to strike your fellow? Not why did you strike, but why are you going to strike? Because for such lovers of the Jewish people, the very event of a fight, even without an actual strike, is contrary to their nature and therefore termed wicked.
He turned to Dayton and Aviram and says, you guys, you're ready to die for your brothers. How could it be that you're fighting? You're fighting, it's not contrary to your nature. Your whole job is not this. It's like two Hasidic Jews are fighting. He said, your job is all to spread Judaism, to spread love. And you're fighting with each other. It's contrary to your whole essence, to your all what you're presenting, what you're dedicating your life to love your fellow Jew, and you're eating up each other alive. As a result,
Dayton and Aviram are the ultimate source for this principle. We see in their case that going against nature and regular practice earns one the moniker of wicked, even without an actual strike. Similarly, any person who lifts their hand against their fellow is abusing the nature and purpose of their hand and are therefore termed wicked, even without laying an actual blow.
It's not, Dayton and Aviram did not lift up their hands. But just as Dayton and Aviram went against their own essence, their own essence was to protect the Jewish people, says, you are ready to be beaten up for another Jew and you are rich with all the fighting. What's wrong with you? It's not who you are. It's not what you dedicated your life for. From this we learn that the end is also, by a regular person, the end is the most important, the focus of his life, of doing good. And when you use your end to do the opposite, it's worse than any other part of your body. You know, you're expecting from a rabbi to be more loving than a regular person. Because his whole job is to spread love. Then when you see a rabbi is doing, you say, you? Well, a regular person, no. But you dedicated your life for doing good. How could you do this? And the rabbis have to be more careful. That's a problem. I'm sorry. Then the same thing is here. I think when the Rebbe spoke about it, he talked to the Hasidim. It was at that time was a fighting cow nights. And the Rebbe basically said, all of you are dedicated to do good. You're going around and you're dedicating your life. You're ready to go to Zambia and to Alaska and to the moon to spread Judaism because you love every Jew. And then you're fighting with each other. It's against your own essence. That's what the Rebbe was really saying. And the same thing is about the end. Or a couple is fighting. You are there to do everything for your children and then you fight within each other. And that's what he says about that. Go ahead. Mr. Phil?
Derogatory speech.
We come to speech also. That's not only the end. Relax.
Derogatory speech against nature. The story of the coming of Aaron continues that they informed Moses to Pharaoh. Upon seeing that there are wicked slanderers among the Jewish people, Moses was concerned that they weren't worthy of being redeemed as a result. Derogatory speech also expresses a change of nature. The function of the tongue is to speak positive words, words of Torah, goodness, and holiness. By uttering derogatory speech, a person is abusing the function of their tongue, similarly to raising a hand against their fellow.
Yeah, next to raising a hand, next in line is your mouth, your speech. Absolutely, your speech is the next one to action. Is your word. There is action, word, and thoughts. Word is very powerful. You can change the world with a good word. You can destroy the world with a good word. Then he says, what was this, the end of the story? Moses said, when they reported on Moses to Pharaoh, Moses says, oh, I'm afraid now that's why they don't deserve, why they suffer so much in Egypt and they don't deserve to be redeemed. Because they are ready to speak Lashon Hara to the government against the Jewish brother. They are ready to inform another Jew to the government to put him in risk. He can be died. They were ready to kill, to inform Moses to the government, and they knew that to be a death sentence. That means to say again, with the word, look what they do with the mouth instead of doing the good. We can learn from it. Bederman, you want to finish the two last paragraph?
We can learn from this story a practical lesson. In addition to the obvious point of how careful we must to respect others and not so much as raise a hand against them, we can also learn a positive lesson that irrespective of how much we have already achieved with love of our fellows and helping other Jews, we can and must continue to increase in this regard, going beyond our previous standard. This is raising a hand for our fellows in a positive sense.
Yeah, raise a hand and doing anything for them. That's what you have to learn from that. Go out of your way to do good.
Yeah.
Now, that and then I'll be look.
By them, Avraham Dayton, if they told Pharaoh about Moses, how that's kind of like they could be considered still a good people? Why it's the point? I think this is most important thing that they did eventually, you know, like, and I don't think they consider...
They felt that Moses' behavior with killing an Egyptian officer is putting them all at risk. That's what the Jewish
but
people...
Good intentions?
Doesn't make the intention. He puts, you kill an Egyptian, now we will all suffer, the whole nation.
They understood... That by doing this,
he's a danger.
His life.
Yeah, he's dangerous to society. Yes,
he's
that's what many communists are thinking. Yeah. Huh?
He's like who's
cannon. Yes, yes.
This guy today, tomorrow,
he's going to do. Yeah. Absolutely. So. I mean, that's what I mentioned before the uprising in the Warsaw ghetto. They blame the people who make the uprising that they are putting it to his dull ghetto. And that's what actually true, because the whole ghetto was put in fire and they killed everybody. I don't judge who was right, who was wrong. I'm just telling you, from their point of view, if somebody is an informer, you say, this guy puts all of us at risk. We have to get him out. Or somebody is a big troublemaker, creates problems. So this guy will make the authorities angry. Because of him, we will all suffer. Jews did these things, what Dayton Aviram did, 1,000 times over Jewish history. 1,000 times in the wrong choice, wrong decisions, right, whatever it is, but it will happen too often.
But you see, you kind of just said in the beginning at least, but again, he took them, they went through the whole process of all the miracles and they went out of Egypt and they still had this something that they...
Obviously, why they went out of Egypt? God didn't judge them ultimately because they had some good intention there. You could excuse their behavior. Until it came to the point of Korach, that you saw there was no good behavior. That was it. But God is very, very merciful. He gives you another chance, another chance, another chance, another chance. He gave them so many chances until they ruined it. What do you wanted to say?
So I guess characterization would be that in Egypt, in the minds of Tetan Avram, they felt they were trying to protect the Jewish people to keep them alive.
Exactly. Yes. Dayton and Aviram felt they're protecting them. When you have one of the Jewish communities doing such ridiculous things, you put everybody in danger. You're going to call an Egyptian officer kill an Egyptian officer in 1994 in Berlin. You crazy? There would be a good excuse. How many times in the ghetto they hurt one person, and because of this they came in and they killed 40 people, 50 people, 100 people, tortured everybody,
yeah.
Millions of times. And other Jews. Gave in, said who the guy who did it, because they said he's putting us all at risk.
I have another one that kind of bothers me over the years. It's one question. The revolt of Judea against Rome, you're revolting against an empire, right? You pretty much know that with a high, very high chance you're going to lose and your country is going to stop existing. So in a case like this, I mean, was this the right thing to revolt?
Not necessarily, no. No, not necessarily. It was a big argument between the rabbis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Rabbi Akiva said yes. The other rabbi said no. It was a big argument. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he escaped from Jerusalem a short time before Jerusalem was destroyed. He went to the Roman commander and general, and he told them, forget about it, they are crazy. Let us run away to a different city. We'll take out anybody who wants to save, and let us leave. We are not against you. I mean, it's not black and white. Nothing is black and white.
You had the same thing with Hasmoneans and the Greeks. They went against an empire.
Yeah, but this was a fight that started and was successful.
Don't you have to have a line which of sacrifice that can't be crossed? Where you say that's where I stand up.
Yes. The question is what the line is and who decides. That's the question.
That's right.
And it's very fluid. That's a problem.
It changes all the time.
Kind of like
it doesn't, but it's debated all the time.
Exactly, it's debated. And with the Maccabees did it. They did it the right way. They were fighting. They were trying to. There was a religious war. It was not just. We cannot be under the control of Rome. You understand?
In